Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Keith Conway. On this episode, I interview the top three finalists in the LeMay Center's Inspiring Doctrinal Innovation Essay Contest for the fall of 2023. Three talented officers talk about how Mission Command may change the way the Air Force organizes, plans, and executes during war. Please join us. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for being here on this edition of the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. Thanks for taking the time out to chat with us this morning. I'd like to start just by thanking all of our contestants in the essay contest this year. We had a great group of papers, but these three stuck out. And so we want to get your thoughts and talk about your papers in particular and give you a chance to expand upon your ideas and your discussion of our prompt. So just as a reminder for our listeners, our prompt for the fall essay contest was, how should Air Force Doctrine Publication 1-1 Mission Command change the way the Air Force organizes, plans, or executes at the operational level of war? That was what our contestants wrote their papers about. Again, great batch of papers, but we had three finalists, and so we'll just announce those now. So our third place winner was Major Jerome Limoges. Second place was U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Brian Blaine, and first place winner was Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Berry. And I've got all three of those gentlemen on the line with us this morning, and we're going to talk about papers. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Major Jerome Pi Limoges. So Pi, you have the floor. Tell us about yourself and give us a short review of your paper, please.
Hey, thanks, Pabst. For the intro, Major Jerome Pi Limoges, as in Pi all Limoges, actually a guardsman out of the Colorado Air National Guard, had a bit of an interesting career over there, did about a decade or so as a civil engineering officer before cross-training over to space. Now currently about one of 1,000 or so Air Guard space professionals, no longer really fit into the Air Force, but have not been assessed into the Space Force. So a little bit orphaned at the moment operationally. Making this call from deployed location in Northwest Africa. So forgive any static or delay. We're going to do the best we can. One quick note, speaking as a reserve component member, I'd like to really thank the LeMay Center. And it sounds like Colonel Underwood was a lot of the driving force behind putting this essay contest forward. Being more tactically focused, within the reserve components, we get fewer opportunities to participate in some of these events where we get to research, think, and write about strategic or doctrinal topics. So I do appreciate the LeMay Center for opening the aperture of this up to the total force and providing my airmen the opportunity to think through some doctrine topics. With that said, my paper was really written over some thoughts I had had through various AOC assignments, witnessing how much the Air Force centralizes control, and even when we distribute control, how much we rely on the centralized AOC concept for synchronization and deconfliction of forces. I started with a thought experiment of what if the AOC ceased to exist tomorrow, whether that's a result of some kinetic attack, cyber or electronic action, or in the case of a hardened facility, you might survive a kinetic attack, but your fiber optic lines and SATCOM antennas likely wouldn't, making it indistinguishable from a full AOC outage. The joint doctrine answer in that case is the joint force commander assumes a lot of those air component commander type roles, which to my mind is an untenable solution given the size, composition, and focus of JFC staffs, which then pulled, okay, as a thought experiment, can mission command as a tool be used to force some of that AOC function down to the tactical echelon? And how do you use almost self-organizing tactical echelon forces to execute AOC-like tasking tasks? Given the limits of the paper length, I use targeting as a specific example. If I were permitted to write further on the topic, I think there's potentially some more interesting areas you could go. air refueling being one, global airlift being another, but given its almost universality, I went with targeting and strike and how you would move some of the AOC functions, such as allocation of targets or weaponeering of effects, down to a tactical echelon, and how a tactical echelon could self-organize to meet some of those. Interesting conclusions. One novel conclusion I reached, particularly when you start to look at more global conflicts or conflicts on a larger theater scale, it suddenly makes a lot more sense to self-organize along communication modalities than it does based off geographic proximity. As kind of a toy example, if I have forces on adjacent islands in an ocean that cannot communicate with each other, or their communication is of such a low bandwidth or high delay that it's unsuitable for coordination, that they're almost more isolated from each other despite their geographic proximity than units thousands of miles away with which they can reliably communicate. So a lot of the ideas of self-organization were borrowed from some of the work to come out of DARPA, later expanded amongst numerous authors. But that was amongst the more unique takeaways I came across working through this topic.
Okay. Yeah, I think that the discussion that you had in your paper about the Interim Air Expeditionary Task Forces was really interesting, because that is a product we're discussing before we hit record. That's a project that has been talked about and discussed multiple times. I'm personally not sure where we stand on some of those answers. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with what you're hinting at, which has to do with what are the communications capabilities we have? What are the means by which those disaggregated units within an air expeditionary task force are going to be able to communicate with each other in the absence of an AOC, if that were to occur? So solid thoughts, solid conclusions in that paper. There was some other interesting discussion in there about using AI and machine learning to do some of the targeting stuff. Man, I really enjoyed reading your paper and actually seeing some concrete applications for some of these technologies that we keep hearing about and seeing where they could actually be put into practice. So yeah, great work on your paper there. Lieutenant Colonel Brian Blaine from the U.S. Marine Corps. Sir, tell us about your paper.
Yeah, so you asked for a little background earlier, so I guess I'll start with that, and then I'll tie that into the paper. Those two topics kind of tie together well. First is, how did a Marine end up writing a paper for the Air Force on mission command? And I'll answer that. I'm here at the Air War College as a student. I was really wanting to write on mission command for the Marine Corps, as it's been a huge part of what we do and a huge part of our culture. We are good at it at times, we're bad at it at times. And it's this cyclical thing to where when we're required to be good at it, we get good at it, and then we lose those capabilities. And so we got really good at it in the Middle East. And as we've come out of it, we've started to get away from it. And now we're looking toward the Pacific. We're realizing, like, well, hey, wow, as we conduct expeditionary advanced-based operations, which is looked at as agile combat employment for small units for the Marine Corps, as you look at agile combat employment for the Air Force, we have the same problems, right? So I'll tie back to that in a second. But so background, I'm a prior enlisted Marine, enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1995. So I'm getting close to the end, about three or four more years left of this thing. I commissioned as an officer in 04. And then what I'll hit is the things that I've done that tie to mission command versus the things that I've done that throughout my career. So as a lieutenant, I deployed to Ramadi, and I watched the battalion commander have his unit spread out between Ramadi and almost to Fallujah, right? He preached mission command as a way to do that and execute it. So I watched him battle with doing it well in areas and doing it bad in areas, right? And then I find myself a few years later as a company commander in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. I've got about a 250-man company. My headquarters was 80 linear kilometers away from my farthest unit. So in 13 position stretched out over 80 linear kilometers, my farthest unit was in a position to where I could only communicate with them through HF Patchat and a sloping V, if you guys are familiar with, like, this big antenna that you stretch out expeditionarily, try to communicate over HF, right? I mean, that's it, right? So you get pretty good at mission command. Then I come out of that and I find myself as a recruiting station commander in Iowa. After I looked up where Des Moines, Iowa was on the map to see where I was going, the next thing I did was figure out where the units were located. Well, 30 two different positions stretched out from North Platte, Nebraska to Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, throughout Iowa and Nebraska. And many of those was just one young 24-year-old E5 sergeant by himself. So again, right, wow, how do you get command and control in this environment? Well, mission command's the answer, and I was lucky to have some experience to drive to that. And then just prior to this, I had a headquarters in St. Louis, and then I had inspector instructor staff, which is something kind of unique for the Marine Corps, stretched out between Montgomery, Little Rock, Nashville, and Springfield. So again, how do you command and control in that environment? So as I was talking to that with Rock, with a director at Air War College, he's like, man, I know you're wanting to do that and talk about the Marine Corps, but you know, maybe you'd learn something if you dove into the Air Force and looked at how we do it and maybe answer this prop. So I say, okay, let's do that. So before talking about the paper here, I'd like to talk about everybody else's papers and how they tied together. I thought that was amazing. As I started looking at mine, this guy that has little knowledge of the Air Force, I'm looking at the things that I thought were important. I was like, wow, so much of this stuff overlaps. This is pretty cool. When you see people start to see the same things, you start to come up with real answers, right? All right. So looking at three things here in this paper, as I evaluated why mission command is important, I saw agile combat employment and the requirements to communicate and command and control in a calm, contested environment, in a distributed environment, and consider how does the Air Force need to get to that? First, structure, right? And that was, and the prompt led to that. And I think everybody tackled that a little bit, but how do you structure in order to do that? You can't execute mission command until you get the structure right to do so, right? You can't even train to it until you get the structure right to do so. In my evaluating of what the Air Force does, I found the Air Force in the 1990s structuring pretty well to do so in the 1990s and realizing that it cost too much money and it was hard to do that and maintain the bases. So you kind of pull back for it. And then I got lucky enough to hear General Slife speak, and he says, hey, we're really working on this thing called the Aerial Task Force, Air Task Force. This is kind of how it looks. I'm like, wow, man, that sounds very much like the air combat element for the Marine Corps, what we call the ACE. So when he's talking about how you'll put this unit somewhere, but he doesn't talk about how that looks in execution and in how low of a level you might need to go. We were discussing earlier, maybe this isn't relevant at the squadron level as the Marine Corps does it versus how it is relevant, you know, at the wing element for the Air Force. I don't think you know. And I've done an enormous amount of wargaming now, a little bit at the schoolhouse, but a lot in OPLAN planning over the last couple of years. And I think when you start spreading this thing out in the environment, you might have to go to a smaller level than you think you need to in order to stay distributed enough to not be targetable, right? And so maybe you need to go down to the squadron level and be capable of independently operating. And I think that's where I saw the real problem with the current Air Force structure is I learned that the Air Force is designed around operating a base. And then from that base, if you could move all those people somewhere and do something, you could do the things that you need to do in a distributed environment. But you can't do that because you got to run this base. You don't have the linking files. And I'll hit a little bit about this when we talk about culture later, but General Slife talked about a rotational force, much like the ACE. Well, that's how you get there. You don't have to spend the money to do that all the time. You can structure for a period of time based off the mission. And you can do that at the wing level. You can do it at the squadron level, both wing and squadron level. And we'll call it modular and scalable structure, support each other in execution when you get there. So I think that that's a model in preparation that the Air Force could really look at. The next thing I looked at was mission style orders for mission command. And I think this is nothing new to the Air Force, right? You guys have talked mission style orders forever, as the Marine Corps has. And we both tend to lose it for control. And so we get away from being able to really just employ someone to execute a task and have them do it at the best of their ability. And what we try to do is give them all the details on how to do it, right? Which is what the air tasking order looks like now. And so in 14, I ran the strike cell in Baghdad for ISIS. Actually, I set it up to get it started. And as I started looking at how to stack aircraft to be able to see and hear and strike, I started diving into what the air tasking orders were looking like, mostly coming off of the bush. And I was like, wow, we're tasking individual aircrafts to do all these things. That's, and I think somebody hit that in their paper. That's amazing. Amazing, one, that you can even do that, the amount of detailed planning that it takes to do that. But amazing, too, the lack of flexibility, that we're not really structured to be flexible. Works in that environment, but not in all environments, right? So I think we have to get to a point to where we are comfortable getting a caravan instead of the Ferrari that we asked for, right? Because they can kind of do the same thing. So we have to get comfortable saying, task and purpose, build me a vehicle to get to the mall, and realize that even though I wanted a Ferrari that was going to get me there really, really fast, I got a caravan that's a little bit different. It still gets me there. I can still meet mission accomplishment, and it allows your subordinates to be more creative in accomplishing that task, because what your people realized was that there was more of us that had to get to that location than what you originally thought, sir. So I had to build this caravan instead. And I think when we get away from mission style order, we start driving off the cliff because we have this task on how to do it and we get there. So I think getting to that's important. And then finally culture. I'll dive more into this, but I think the Air Force has gone through a reverberation of LeMay, man. I hate to say this, in the LeMay Center. LeMay had to do these things really fast, right? When LeMay was figuring out how to get aircraft off the ground in 15 minutes carrying nuclear warheads, he needed a really good checklist that could be executed really fast and rehearsed to do so. And I think that forced the Air Force down a road that led away from mission command. And it's just reverberated through the years. And I think right now you're trying to get away from that a little bit. And I think you're going in the right track to do so. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But that's me. And that's kind of how I got to writing this paper. And then that's kind of how I learned a little bit about the Air Force and how you guys do business. So
awesome. Fantastic. Yeah, I think there's a lot to unpack there. And of course, the mission command as a leadership philosophy is not new.
No.
You know, it goes way back to past even the German military and Austrian Taktik and beyond. Yeah. And it's not even new to the Air Force, but like you stated, how we got away from that structure because of the nature of the conflicts we were in over the few years. And now we're trying to work our way back. And I think that there are some cultural elements that were taken away from our previous Air Force life when we were a nuclear base, annihilation-based force that was structured around, it was heavily structured around the employment of nuclear weapons at the time, right? Yeah. Which is something that I still think we would agree needs to be very centrally controlled.
That's what mission style orders are for, right?
Right. Yeah. And what that's evolved into and what that's begotten to us over the years has, it has evolved and it's changed drastically. It's been cyclical. So I think that we have a lot to take away from the Marine Corps style of organizing and employing. Some of what you're alluding to with how the aviation combat element is structured in the Marine Corps is similar to what Colonel Barry talks about in his paper as well. So Colonel Barry, we'll move to you and ask you the same question. So sir, tell us briefly about yourself and about your paper.
Hey, thanks, Paps, and thanks, Pi and Brian, for teeing this thing up. My name is Matthew Berry. I go by Baja. I'm a pilot in the Air Force. Spent the bulk of my career flying U-28s down with AFSOC. Right now, I'm assigned to the Strategic Execution Group at Headquarters Air Force. That's a very fancy name for a far less impressive actual job description. What I do is I plan and execute conferences for the Chief of Staff and for the Secretary of the Air Force. So right now we're putting the finishing touches on the MAGCOM Commanders Conference. After that, we'll work on Corona, and the cycle kind of repeats itself. The reason I bring that up is any time of the year, it's a fascinating job. Right now, it's really, really fascinating because it's given me a front row seat to some of the big changes that the Air Force is trying to make institutionally. So I get to be in the peanut gallery watching some of these changes with a lot of time on my hands to think. And so thank you, the LeMay Center, for giving me the opportunity to put some of those ideas down on paper. Let's talk about my idea, if you will. And here's the advantage of going third, is I get to build off of everything that Pi and Brian said. And even better, I get to pass their ideas off as my own, which I'm a huge fan of. So we can pick up this conversation halfway through, right? We can start under the assumption that mission command is a really good way to overcome some of the command and control challenges for a fight in the Pacific. So you already heard from Pi about why our AOC is vulnerable, why the centralized control model is vulnerable. Brian is alluding to some of the cultural challenges that the Air Force faces in shifting back to a mission command type culture. I'm super interested in that, so I'm not going to steal his thunder, so I'm going to stay away from that part of the conversation. Where I think I have something valuable to add is I'm going to expand on some of the structural barriers that stand between the Air Force and effective mission command. So as I see it, the problem boils down to this. The Air Force is a functionally organized service. The Air Force fights as a system, not necessarily as a conglomeration of semi-independent combat-generating formations. That's really important, so I'm going to say it one more time. The Air Force is a functionally organized service that fights as a system, not as a collection of semi-independent combat-generating formations. What does that mean? So when I say functionally organized, what I'm saying is that up and down the echelons of the Air Force, when we're talking squadrons, wings, MAGCOMs, the predominant line of demarcation is functional specialty. It is your AFSC. You have to get really high up in our organizational structure before a maintainer and a medic, for example, report to the same boss. The second piece of that, what do I mean when I say we fight as a system? The effects that the Air Force produces are a complex interaction of all those different functional specialties. So by itself, a bomber or a flight of bombers is completely worthless. It's only when we combine the bomber with the other functions, you know, intelligence, maintenance, munitions, et cetera, it's only when we combine that that the bomber has any value in producing an effect. But what's the third part I said? We don't fight as a conglomeration of semi-independent combat-generating formations. We are in the modern military. Everyone, no matter who you are, fights as a part of a system. That applies to when Lieutenant Colonel Blaine was an infantry officer in Helmand. That applies just as much to when Pi is working complex problems in the space environment. Everyone, we all fight as part of a system. But in the Air Force and the Space Force, the lowest level at which we have semi-independent combat generation power is the wing. And even that is kind of stretching the definition of independent combat generation power. No one else in the other services is drawing the line that high. And that's interesting. So when I combine those kind of three qualities about how the Air Force fights, I come up with this theory that if you're going to try and do mission command, and specifically, I mean, if you're going to try and delegate authority in a structure like this, pretty quickly, you're going to run into two problems. Problem number one, you create a mismatch between authority and resources. So it's really easy for a wing commander to say, hey, squadron commander, go get after this mission. But it's really hard once you tell the squadron commander to do that. It's hard for them to apportion the resources to enable them to do so because we're not entirely clear where those resources are coming from and who else are using those resources. So the way we get around this problem normally is through support relationships, but those only work when the supported and the supporting commander have a common operating perspective, which brings me to big problem number two. We don't have a common operating perspective. Our subordinate commanders, I'm talking about those at the wing level and below, because they only lead in their functional expertise, they struggle to understand what the other functions bring to their organization. And this isn't a slight against any individual squadron commander. It's just something that takes lots of reps to get right. And you don't get those reps until you are commanding multifunctional groups of airmen. So if you don't get the reps, the first time you're really trying to do it is when you're deployed under an ACE concept. And trying anything for the first time in combat, as we know, probably not a good recipe for success. So that's the problem as I see it. How do we get around this? Well, I think you have to break some glass. And what I mean by that is what I propose is it's time to break the traditional Air Force squadron. And so my big idea, if you will, is that I would disaggregate the support squadrons and I would incorporate them into the operational squadrons. So are you flight line maintenance? I want to pull you out of the maintenance group and I want to put you in the ops squadron. Are you flight medicine? I'm pulling you out of the med group. I'm putting you in the squadron. Are you intel? Are you comms? Are you munitions? You know, you get the point. There's a lot of functionalities that I want to pull out of those stovepipes and put them into the operational squadron. That's the idea. But in my paper, I try and translate that big idea into some details. I ask the question, what gets disaggregated, what doesn't? I look at the functional specialty scale based on mission demand versus geographic demand. I look at minimum and maximum viable sizes of different functions. I look at the longitudinal breakout of mission demarcation. And I use all that to kind of build these rules of thumb on how you could build these functionally integrated squadrons. All those things matter. They're all important, but that's just the tactics. That's just the execution details in which I'm going to take the specific mission of your wing. I'm going to put a bunch of, you know, smart staff officers to work on it, and they're going to pump out that product. It's a problem that we can solve. The important part that I want everyone to take away is that once you start mixing these functional specialties, particularly at the squadron level, you really put a meaningful dent in the mismatch between authorities and resources, and you put a big dent in the limited perspective of subordinate commanders.
Awesome. Thank you, Colonel Baird. A phrase that you just used in that really stuck out to me, you said, the Air Force fights as a system. And that's a great way to characterize something that we've been discussing here at the LeMay Center. And something I've been thinking about is like how the Air Force actually gets to effect. It is the sum of so many different parts, of so many different systems, especially with regards to ISR and sustainment. And the way that we currently organize our forces for the collection, fusion, and distribution of intelligence, and then how our sustainment works. And like Colonel Blaine was saying, it's operate a base. A lot of it focuses around operating a base. So I think that was very well stated, and it rolls into a question that I wanted to ask. So Major Lemos, you talked a lot about what happens if the Air Operations Center loses connectivity or we become disconnected from it. How do you continue to force package air power weapon systems that are distributed across the theater in a contested, degraded, operationally limited environment?
Hey, thank you, sir. Great question. I think the key to success in doing so, with a nod towards Brian, is what the Marine Corps likes to say, the key is to have a bias towards action. Whether I isolate forces down to a single opportune ace airfield that has, you know, two A-10s and a couple of MQ-9s, or rather whether I can follow my remaining lines of communication out to encompass a region, I'm still left with some assets. I gave two examples in my paper that, because of space, I didn't get to pull the thread on as much as I would have liked to. But the first is, you may not be as isolated as you think should you look outside the scope of traditional communication. So I gave one example in terms of sharing ISR. I think I used the example of the F-16 sortie with a box of classified hard drives behind the seat, potentially create a very high bandwidth, albeit high latency mechanism, by which we can pass messages a la Horatio Nelson, literal pieces of paper or matter that's going back and forth, or the 21st century equivalent of using airborne or afloat assets as limited bandwidth relay. Even if it's as simple as, okay, right seater, you are now the battle manager telephone game for the region with which we have some remaining RF connectivity. The second concept that I touched upon briefly, and I'll use a saying I got from Army artillerymen, and I wish I had the original attribution, but the effective delivery of fires sends a message your adversary will understand quite clearly. Well, conversely, while we look at having potentially isolated forces operating independently of each other, at campaign day in, the left hand may not be aware of what the right hand's doing. But assuming that both isolated forces maintain a bias for action and their commanders continue to project sorties. And again, I use kind of a targeting kinetic strike perspective in my paper, but you can open the aperture to airlift or ISR or whatever activity you'd care to analyze. Day N plus one, I can look out and I may not know from direct communication what isolated force Bravo was doing. I may not be able to see the direct effects of isolated force Bravo, but if I'm isolated force Alpha, I can look out and I can see the second and third order effects of what isolated force Bravo did. So while we may not be in the traditional sense of operational or tactical mission planning able to sit at the same or virtual table and hash out, all right, I'll take list X, you can take list Y. 2 days later, through observation using my own inherent assets, whether that's ISR assets or whether it's the Mark One eyeballs of my retained forces, I can infer, okay, based on the higher order effects of what I am seeing forward, I can infer that isolated force Bravo is performing this set of activities, and I can adjust my planning and my priorities accordingly. As long as you maintain that mission command culture and a bias for action, and the isolated forces are driving towards something in accordance with the rails and vision left by the JFAC before their unfortunate demise, virtually or literally, you should still be able to communicate, even if that communication is very indirect through changes affected in the operational environment.
Yeah, that's a fantastic answer. Fantastic way to explain that. As you kind of alluded to as well, there are some technological solutions to this problem as well, and especially as we move into the future and the forthcoming technologies behind ABMS and some of those C2 systems as we move into the future. So hopefully those help us out with that problem as well. Lieutenant Colonel Blaine, I know you've got a lot to say on the cultural aspects. I'm going to let Major Limoges ask you that question here in just a moment. But what I wanted to know, coming from the Marine Corps side, you spoke to the aviation combat element, and that's how the Marine Corps employs air power within the MEU or the MEB. How does a aviation combat element organize and train together, and how do you command control that aviation combat element, and what are the lessons that the Air Force can learn from the Marines relative to how you employed that unit?
I think we talk man, train, and equip, and how we do that, how we organize the man, train, and equip. We have to look at something that Baja mentioned earlier, which is resources. So I'll let that drive us into how we do that. Baja said, you know, problem one, like resources, as we get ready to do this thing where we have to reorganize and task organize for a mission, we got to figure out what resources go where. And we don't really have enough resources to do this thing. The air tasking order, unfortunately, doesn't allow you to really figure that out. I've been through the ATO planning cycle a couple times, and it is an extremely effective tool that will allow you to really build detailed plans, and that's great. But one side of the spectrum is the air tasking order, I would say, and then the other side of it, which is extremely detailed, and the other side of that spectrum is mission command. And then the answer is always somewhere along that line, right? It's either far left, and it's extremely detailed sometimes, but sometimes it's far right, and sometimes it is, this is your task, and this is your purpose, now you go execute. And so the Air Force figuring out how to do that. Thing one, figure out what your main effort is. As you reorganize, you figure out what your main effort is, and then figure out how to weight that main effort, right? You're not always going to be right, but you've got to do that in order to figure out how to do that. So I think that helps get to that problem that he's talking about. And how do we do that? We do that, and we decide what assets do we need for this mission. And so you talked about the MEB and the MEU. All of those fall under what we call the Special Purpose MAGTAF, or MAGTAF, Marine Air Ground Task Force. And everything we do is executed as a MAGTAF. So it's got the ground element, the logistic element, the command and control element, and the logistics combat element, right? So we've got all of those things. And then at a smaller level, we bring that into what we call the ACE. And I think that's where you're going. We have to decide what goes into the ACE. And it can be different depending on the mission. I think this is what the Air Force can take from the Marine Corps. Is first we do this planning to figure out what our main effort is and what our mission looks like. And then from that, we decide what this ACE is going to look like. What assets does it need? So for the Air Force, as I identify an island in the Marianas that I'm going to have assets on, what needs to be there at that location based off of my mission? And that is it's some security, some logistics. That logistics means some maintenance requirements. Well, how much of that based off of platforms that I have there? I think that's what the Air Force can pull from us is look at how we get to the point of how we set that up and then figure out how to do that. I think that'd go a long way. And I say modular and scalable. I think a mistake that you could make is going down the road of trying to build another fixed unit that's always the same, right? I think you have to really get used to plugging and playing, and that comes through repetition and training on what those units look like. So I think you go back to your training, and as you design your training scenarios, you make a commander task organize those units to be able to do that thing and execute that mission.
Perhaps, do you mind if I kind of pile on what Brian said there?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
All three of us have thrown some shade, if you will, at the ATO. And I think there's a nuance there that I want to make sure comes across. We're not against the ATO. The ATO provides a very valuable function in combining different capabilities to tackle a problem set. So if you want to take down a modern IAD, you need some function like an ATO that can get everyone on the same sheet of music as far as how you're going to take down that complex structure. So you need that. What we're just saying is that there are also situations where the dissemination of the ATO is not going to work, either because of the communication limitations or because the entity distributing it doesn't have the battlefield awareness that they think they have. And in those situations, we need a complementary mechanism of mission command to fill that gap. What is fascinating is that the Marine Corps reacts to the ATO in a very different way than the Air Force does, at least by my perception, is that the MEF and the MU play a far more active role in how Marine Corps assets are apportioned in the ATO than, say, a wing commander does on the Air Force. And it's that engagement, it's that, call it, what it is, kind of the protection of my assets that enables a MEF and a MU, I think, to do ATO and or mission command both effectively at the same time.
Yeah, and we go back and forth on when we're good at it and when we're not, right? I mean, like, we're not always good at it in execution. We got out of the Middle East and started focusing on just training, and we completely lost the drive to do that. And then we start looking at the Pacific and go, wow, hey, there's some distributed stuff going on here. We got to try to get good at that again. And then so then we battle to get back to it, right? So it's just a cycle that we all go through, man. But yeah, I think there is very detailed planning. And then there is the building of the capability, right, to be able to not be so detailed and to give commanders intent and execution. And they are both important. I think I mentioned this earlier. If you looked at us on a spectrum, the commander needs to be able to decide where he wants to fall on that spectrum as how he employs his force.
So having scalable forces, having it be modular, like you're talking about, it's very valuable. And that is something that the Air Force's Air Task Force presentation model is trying to get at.
Right.
So this Air Task Force presentation model, the concept that we're working on right now, the white paper came out back in the fall from the SecApps office trying to explain how we're going to do this. So I think that having the scalable modular structure is something that the Air Force Air Task Force concept is trying to get at. Colonel Barry, something I wanted to ask you, does the Air Force's Air Task Force concept solve the challenges you identified in your paper with functionally organized forces with respect to authorities versus resources and barriers to communication?
Yeah, so I do think ATF is a huge step in the right direction. As long as we're only fighting small-scale wars, as long as we can ensure that the ATF commander's always going to have good communications with the subordinate units, as long as the entire ATF is based at the same geographic location, then I think, yes, the ATF solves the problem. But if those aren't good assumptions, and I would argue that in the Pacific against the adversaries we're likely to face, those are not good assumptions, then we still have some more work to do. So it's no surprise. I'm a big fan of ATF, and I think we could even expand that language to include things like the deployable combat wings, which is a newer initiative of the Air Force, but they all get the same problem. And it is an evolutionary approach when we connect the lines between XAVs, ATFs, and DCWs. I apologize for the incoherent babble of alphabet soup that just came out of my mouth. But they're all getting at the same thing. There's a mismatch in the way we organize home station and in the way we organize when we fight. I don't know that the two need to be the same exact thing, but they definitely need to be able to translate to each other. So ATF and DCWs, they do that at the large force offering level. They take the leadership structure of the wing, they tailor it to the environment, they build in dedicated time for team building, and that's super important, and then out pops the command layer of an ATF. But that's not necessarily being done for all the individual mission generation force elements that nest under the ATF. When is the team building between air crew, maintenance, weather, intel, when is that occurring? And I would argue that it doesn't do so under ATF as deliberately as we need. But that's my assessment. That's an opinion. As soon as the ATF, which let's just remember, the ATF is a hub-sized force. It's not a spoke-sized force. As soon as that ATF divides, you're right back to the same familiar problems of authority and resource mismatch, common operating perspective mismatch. If I can expand on it a little further, I know I'm taking a lot of mic time here. I think analogy really helps us here. And so ATFs are good at enabling mission command at the Air Force echelon equivalent of a brigade. Functionally integrated squadrons, which I'm proposing here, is doing that same thing at the battalion level. So we're talking about the same problem, we're just talking about different levels. We can go lower and higher with that. You know, we could talk about functionally integrated flights, for example. But what determines how high or low we can go is really our resource requirements. The lower we go, the more requirements we're going to generate, and the lower that tooth-to-tail ratio becomes. So we have to be very deliberate. We have to look at our operating environment that we expect to be in and make a conscious decision about how low we want that independent combat-generating element to extend.
Sir, did you have something you wanted to ask him?
Yeah, we fight the same thing. You need to be able to train in your individual job, and then you need to be able to execute somewhere else. And where's the cut line? Can you organize to where you move them over? And if you can, and I think to go to a really, really small element on a battle that we have that is exactly what you're talking about is at the battalion level, we'll go down one more, at the company level, I have a weapons platoon that trains all of my machine gunners, my mortarmen, and my assaultmen. And that they're focused solely on training them, right? But in execution, they can't execute by themselves. So I have to then pull those elements out of that weapons platoon and put them into the rifle platoons to execute. So when does that happen? How long do you need to train them in their individual job? And I think the next one that we struggle with a little bit on our air side is cross-training to be able to work on more than one airframe. Like we're really working hard on that right now. And it happens really good in the MU cycle. So during their training workup, the guy that works on the 53 can then work on the Osprey and can work on the F-35, right? I think that is something that helps out as well. And I don't know the lift to do that, right? But like the capability of that really helps the concept.
So I wanted to give you guys a chance to bounce ideas off of each other and discuss. So Pi, do you have anything you want to ask the other two SA riders while we have them on the line?
I do. So first, a question for Colonel Blaine. You write in your paper about the Air Force's checklist culture and how this LeMay-esque checklist culture pervades, particularly the Air and Space Force, with a newer philosophy that has gone beyond a tool to manage complexity and almost a cookbook that a missile crew who's been up for 3 days could use to muddle through a rote task. This last leaves a little bit of leeway for localized decision-making. From your sister service perspective, what one change would you recommend to the Department of the Air Force checklist culture and how would you drive that change?
Yeah, so this is blasphemy here. I'm sitting in the LeMay Center, and I'm going to say that we should rename this place the Boyd Center. Two renowned Air Force officers, right? But like two opposite ends of the spectrum on how they see the world. And I think your fighter pilot community likes Boyd pretty well. I think the bomber community would not be happy about that change, right? As I've done a little research on Air Force culture and looking at this thing. But, you know, if you look back, we talked earlier about how LeMay really had to have this checklist in order to get aircraft off the ground really fast in the Cold War and how much of a necessity that was. He was also a real Nazi about following the doctoring and the procedures that were provided, right? And like, if it was written down and he signed it, that's what you do, right? Around the same time, then there's Boyd, right? And Boyd is touting the German system as an example of organic command and control. He said, you avoid checklists and technical procedures to facilitate command. A focus on leadership, and this is really important, implicit bonds of a common operational outlook. He refers to the common operational outlook as orientation that allows decentralization. So, you know, of course, we all know the OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, act. He was onto something that would be really good for the Air Force now, maybe. He was just, and we all say he was ahead of his time, probably not so good for the Air Force, you know, when LeMay had the helm, right? So maybe we look back to Boyd. I want to go to a couple things. I think that what Boyd drives can lead to some positive change in culture of mission command. And one is the implicit bond. There's a book called The Five Dysfunctions of the Team written by Lencioni. He talks about trust. What he's talking about isn't like, I can trust that my youngest daughter's room is going to be messy if I go into her room right now. Like, that's not the kind of trust. We're talking about vulnerability-based trust, the kind of trust that you can only gain through shared experience and very often shared hardships, right? And that's being able to really know your boss and then for you as a commander to really know your people. So you have to figure out a way to do that. And I don't think that the Air Force structure now is really designed to make that happen. It doesn't really put commanders and subordinate commanders in arduous situations that allow them to get to know each other well. I think that gets in the way of your ability to trust, because you have to have trust to be able to give commanders intent and know that it's going to be executed. And then you have to have trust that you understand your boss in order to be able to do that. So, you know, how do you do that? One, we have to back away from being so tied to doctrine. Like, doctrine is just the loudest dude in the room. That was often me, right? And that's the real problem. But the loudest dude in the room when new doctrine's being written or designed, right? Like, it's a group of guys that are there writing this thing down, and it's really good for that moment in time. And I really realized this as an Air War College student talking to Air Force officers, and it would always be, let's go back to doctrine. And while I think that's important, there's a saying, be tactically sound, not tactically bound, right? Understand the doctrine, but know that that's a starting point to deviate. And I think that the next step then is to accept that as commanders. I talked earlier about the Ferrari and the caravan, right? Like, you got to accept what you get from your people, right? And it may not be exactly the way that you want it. And you have to do that every day. And then that has to start as second lieutenants. And as you teach them commander's intent to execute mission command, and then it has to happen at every aspect of command at the squadron and below level when you give guidance to subordinates. Force yourself not to tell them how to do everything that they do. Just tell them what you want them to do. So I think that can really help. We struggle with that in the Marine Corps, and we remind each other of it all the time. And it's part of our culture to remind each other of that principle of like, hey, just tell me how to get it done, sir, and I'll get it done. Like, and then you kind of check yourself as a boss and you go, wow, all right, got it. I'll throw this piece of paper out of the way, go get my mission accomplished. It's hard to do. It's not going to happen exactly the way you would do it, but you have to accept that. And so you have to start that. That's something that takes a long time, and it's real easy to lose because we want things done the way that we want it done, right? And so that's something that has to be just imbued into the culture and has to start all the way back with our young second lieutenants as they're learning to be officers. The next is, in order to get people comfortable with not giving the boss exactly what they want, we need to train to failure. And that was in a huge part of all three papers, I think, train to failure. It's really hard in the Air Force because people die when bad things happen in aircraft, right? But you have to figure out a way to train beyond just what you're capable of doing. Every time you train, you have to continue until you don't meet mission success. And believe me, we like to train until we're really good at something and say, hey, we got it. You know, check the box and move on. We have to work really hard, and we don't always do it, at training beyond what our capability level is. So there is, at some point, there's failure, so that as a subordinate, I know that my boss is going to be okay with this possible failure in order to meet to, as we discussed earlier, have a bias for action to execute off the commander's intent that facilitates mission command. And so how do you set those things up? How do you set that environment to make that happen? So that's how I would look at it from an outsider looking in. And you really are structured for that not to happen. We are structured for it to happen, and we screw it up. So, or we mess it up.
Pi, you got anything else?
I do. I've actually got a question for Baja. Sir, as the Space Force has developed a fairly unique and flat organization structure, some of the features of Space Force organization sound a lot like what you proposed in your paper. For example, squadrons that incorporate weapon operation, weapon maintenance, and force projection analog of sortie generation under one commander. Additionally, when you see Delta standing up that combine many of the functions traditionally seen in operations groups, wings, and even NAFs, does the Space Force model approach what you've envisioned for functionally integrated squadrons? And is there value in using the Space Force, which is fairly flexible and malleable at this point in history, as a laboratory of sorts to try out the functionally integrated squadron concept?
Hey, thanks, Pi. That's a great question. Yes, inherently, the smaller size of the Space Force, and we can include the Marine Corps in this as well, like both those services are relatively small. It gives those smaller services more flexibility when it comes to organizational change and experimentation. If the Air Force is not using Space Force integration and deltas as a testing ground to fail forward, that is a squandered opportunity, period, dot. Here's where I'll add some caution to that sentiment. A delta is not a wing. A wing is not a wing. A fighter wing looks very different than a special operations wing. So we have to be cautious of the temptation to say, Delta, you're the lead Delta for this concept, or wing, you're the lead wing for this concept. Validate this concept, and then we'll apply it to everyone. I've never been a big fan of that method, right? Let's establish the big idea first. Let's establish the concept first, and then give it to the wings, empower them, just like we would with mission command, empower the wings to adapt that concept to how it makes sense for their wing. And it may look very, very different for a wing versus a delta. But I think the fact that Space Force is embracing it is super promising, and there's definitely lessons to be learned.
Colonel Blaine, did you have a discussion point you wanted to bring up or ask Baja about?
I'd just like to hear how you view that. As you start talking about changing the structure, how do you view that in ACE? Like, how do you see one individual location looking? And that's, if you were talking about an ACE maneuver element, I'll say maneuver element, right? I know that probably isn't exactly right, but somewhere in the Marianas as we're trying to spread out our forces. How do you see that?
Thanks. I think that's a really fair question. I don't want to dive too much into the specific of the fight in the Pacific because it's a tempting subject and we could spend all day on it. What I'll say is this, like, there's not many trends in the historical progress of warfare, but I think there's two that are relevant to us, and I'm pretty confident about these two. Number one, the world is shrinking. And what I mean by that is fires are capable of reaching further. If I can see something, I can probably hit it and kill it. And so that's the driving factor behind ACE. And so these hub locations, which I would argue are kind of ATF size locations, and these spoke locations, which are, squadron or mission generation force element size locations, that's kind of our operating assumption, is that we need to fit into those physical airfields at the right size while paying attention to the details of different planes fly different distances, right? So we can't just base all the aircraft at the same location. When you combine that, you come up with a theater specific answer that you can optimize the service for. When you optimize the service for that answer, you are intentionally not optimizing it for other theaters. So the optimal force construct for the Pacific is by definition not the optimal force construct for, say, counterterrorism operations in the Middle East. And that's okay. That needs to be a conscious decision based on our strategic priorities of which one we want to optimize for and which one we don't want to optimize for.
Colonel Barry, I'll let you keep the floor here. As our contest winner, I'll let you have the last questions here. If you've got anything that you want to bring up with the other two papers, now's the opportunity.
Yeah, and maybe this is a nice way of kind of recapping a lot of the conversation. I am not a mission command zealot. I have a love-hate relationship with the term. I think a lot of times we tend to use the word mission command and two people will be using it and they're talking about totally different concepts. So my question to each of you is, when you use the word mission command in your essays, what specific aspect of mission command are you zeroing in on? And then the follow-on question, which is mission command always good or is it contextual? Is it always the right answer? Is there sometimes where centralized control may be the right answer? Let's go to Pi first, if that's okay.
Hey, sir. Thank you. Agreed. It's like a lot of terminology, like safety, a simple word that means something very different to everyone you say it to. One of the key elements to answering your question is I think there's a great deal of fluidity there. We tend to pass around the terrible advice, decision-making to the lowest possible echelon. And then sometimes you'll see well-meaning doctrinaires step back and say, okay, what we really mean is decision-making pushed down to the lowest competent echelon. I think holistically, it's a decision-making goes to the echelon of most appropriate situational awareness, bearing in mind that may be below, above, or sideways. So to me, when I say mission command, it can be bi-direction. There's times that the wing commander, again, using the language of the early 21st century air expeditionary force, is faced with a decision that's pretty obviously joint force commander fodder. I think we do pretty well at pushing that back up. There's other times when the decision should be pushed laterally, and I think mission command as defined and as written about often does a poor job of exploring those scenarios. So to my mind, really mission command is an ability to set intent, constraint, restraint, guide rails, and allow the larger force to work out organically what the correct placement of decision making is based on relevant situational awareness. Kind of like the Air Force definition of doctrine, I just told you a lot of what it wasn't to try and get to what it was. And for that, I apologize. To the second part of your question, there's absolutely circumstances where prescriptive direction and orders are appropriate. To his credit, Brian gave some outstanding examples earlier that I'll not rehash, but the AOC and the ATO endures today because there is a great deal of inherent efficiency and there's some synchronized and coordinated endeavors that we can accomplish that are not easily accomplished, if at all, outside of that. And this extends beyond the air world too. If you're talking space operations where I have to say rendezvous a US GSAP satellite to inspect a potentially damaged U.S. commsat, it's hard to do something like that without pretty intensive coordination. I'm not saying impossible, I am saying ugly. So agreed, there's many places where mission command may not be an appropriate command. Thanks, Pabst.
To the question, the Marine Corps understands collectively what we view as a bias of action, right? I think from the lowest second lieutenant, from the commandant of the Marine Corps, I think you would probably get the same answer from us, right? And that's just because we're a brainwashed organization, if there is one that exists, right? But the way we view mission command is this: it is executing in the absence of orders with a bias for action, being a creative problem solver, right? And so that requires a lot of trust for those subordinate commander to do so. So if I mess that up there, I'll restate that. How does the Marine Corps view mission command? It views mission command as executing in absence of orders with a bias for action as a creative problem solver. And then, is it always good? I think absolutely not, right? Like, there is always a time to where more details are a must. And honestly, I think that there are times where you're capable of being more detailed and prescriptive, that you're better off by being more detailed and prescriptive, even though that you're trying to drive this culture, right? So I'm trying to drive this mission command culture, but in this time and in execution, I'm better off by being prescriptive. So I think the answer is no. And I think earlier I talked about the sliding scale. I think that sliding scale is important. I think the commander decides where that thing falls, right? How prescriptive do I want to be? And then how mission command oriented do I want to be?
All right, gentlemen. Well, this has been a fantastic discussion. I want to congratulate you guys again on being a finalist in our essay contest. Thank you so much for your time this morning and appreciate the excellent conversation and look forward to hearing from you guys in the future. And that'll wrap it up for today. Thanks, gents.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. This show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach Section. Special thanks to AUIX for hosting the IDI essay contest, Air University, and all of our essay contest participants. As always, the views expressed by our panel members are their own and do not necessarily reflect views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Keith Conway. We'll see you next time.